Marty, there's some handouts in the chair back there that you missed. And tonight we're going to talk about chapter 13 of Revelation. And like all the rest of Revelation, it depends upon your understanding of some other parts of the Bible. And what part in particular has a bearing on chapter 13? Daniel chapter 7. And so if you go back to the 7th chapter of Daniel, which we'll do in a few minutes, you get some clues about what chapter 13 is all about. And we'll talk about how we know that that's the case in a minute. Last week we talked about the fact that Satan was chasing Israel. That's secular, and in a sense the total Israel was being protected by God Satan was chasing this woman who represents Israel. And at times we're talking about total Israel, and other times we're talking, particularly when it calls Israel the earth, the land, we're talking about secular Israel and not very religious Israel. The faithful Israel is this woman that we talked about in chapter 12, who gave birth to the Messiah. So we talked last week about the war in heaven, and we were discussing how that war is fought and how it's won. It's a battle over the minds of humanity is what it's really all about. And so Satan got put on earth, and in a sense, that's where he wanted to be, I suppose, because he has access to humanity, doesn't he? And to get even with God, we were discussing this too, that he wants to destroy Adam's race if he can. But, of course, God won't let him do that. And so what was his ploy? We decided, I don't know that it's the only motivation that he has for continuing the battle, but one of the motivations is one that many of your friends hold as well, who are unwilling to obey God and become a Christian. They believe that God is so good that he will not destroy all of humanity. And so certainly he wouldn't send someone to hell. And I think that's, in a way, what Satan is hoping, is that he can hold humanity hostage and somehow bargain with God at the end. But, of course, that's futile. That's not going to happen. And the Bible's very clear about that point. But there's... Satan doesn't have much to fall back upon. He knows his time is short, was one of the verses that we looked at before. So tonight we'll talk about God's view of the two assistants that Satan has. And we don't know where they came from or if it's something Satan created. The fact that they're called beasts, as was the four beasts around the throne and back in chapter 4, suggests that they may be a couple of more cherubim who sinned, as did Satan. And Satan was the cherub to the reptiles, and then these two, we fill in the blanks and try to guess what they were. Intelligent animals who are not represented by the four would include perhaps some sort of a sea creature. And of course, this beast that... Uh-oh. It doesn't work. Where's... We checked this at the start. Yeah.
And...
Yeah. Yeah, I'd go to the next slide. Yeah, you may be stuck there because this was working, and now it doesn't work again. I don't know why. Okay, back up one. Let's go back. There we go. Revelation 13 begins, and the dragon stood on the shore of the sea. Now that verse has, in some There we go. That's a different one. Think that one will work? Yep. And some in some translations, it says, "And I stood on the shore of the sea." That would be John. I don't think it matters much, but the preferred reading, apparently, by the scholars is that the dragon stood there as though he's causing this creature, calling him out of the sea. "And I saw a beast coming out of the sea." Now, we said before that the sea really, technically it's water, but in terms of the symbolism, it represents the idolatrous and sinful nations of the world, those that are not following God. Generally, in the Jewish view of things, these were the Gentiles. "Saw a beast coming out of these nations. He had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name." The blasphemous name suggests what? He's opposed to God. "The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion." And Cleo brought this up when we saw this beast back in chapter 12, waiting to swallow the Messiah when he was born. He's described there in the third chapter, in the third verse of the 12th chapter. "Another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads." And you see, that's this same beast. It isn't Satan. It's Satan's assistant. It's his helper. And so the difference between these two paragraphs in Revelation 12 and Revelation 13 is that here, the 10 crowns are on his horns. And back in the third verse of chapter 12, the 7 crowns were on his heads. So this is at a later time than the one that we saw back in Revelation 12. And that's one reason for believing that represents the long period of time in which Satan was waiting for the Messiah to be born. Didn't know when or where or how. This is at an earlier time. He knew what the prophecies had said about it, and so he knew it was in the time of these kings, because Daniel had revealed all of that revealed to him from the angels. So this is the same creature. Now later on in chapter 17, I think, we'll see it called the scarlet beast. Is there any difference between a red dragon and a scarlet beast? It's just more sophisticated, isn't it? And so it's the same creature again, with the 10 heads, with the 7 heads and the 10 crowns. We'll see him a number of times in here. And chapter 13 here gives us the details about his origin and what he's all about. Now, I told you to go back and read Daniel 7, because to understand these symbols in Revelation, we need to understand the rest of the Bible, because it refers to them with key words and verses, which I gave you in your outline of the book. And in this case, it has to do with Daniel. Daniel 7 and 1 begins by saying that Daniel was asleep on his bed at night in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Daniel had a dream. And so this is a dream vision. It's going to be a little bit dreamy. "And visions passed through my head," through his head, his mind, as he was lying on his bed. "He wrote down the substance of his dreams." And so here's what he saw. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were 4 winds of heaven churning up the great sea." So here, what he's going to see comes out of the SEA as well as the one in Revelation. 4 great beasts, each different from others, came up out of the sea. And they're different in this case. He's looking at them before they occur in history. And John is looking at them after they have all come. And so he shows them to the angel or God shows these to Daniel separately. They're all glued together in Revelation 13. But notice there's a lion, a bear, and a leopard that are involved in these beasts, and those are the same beasts that are mentioned by John in chapter 13. So this is the same thing, just a slightly different version. And things that we learn about it here are applicable, of course, to the one in 13 as well. So the first beast was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off. Ouch. That doesn't sound so good, does it? Had wings, but they were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And I think that's kind of interesting because Daniel had actually seen what, well, I'm not sure at this time if he, yeah, he had. He had witnessed what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was arrogant, and what did God do to him? Yeah, he cut him off at the roots, didn't he, and sent him out into the field for a period of time like a beast, and until he would acknowledge that God Most High was the true God. And so here you're clear that it's a, if it's a government, and we're going to see later on that it is, it has to do with a particular man, in this case, Nebuchadnezzar, who had captured Israel and brought them into captivity. And then he goes on, and there before me was a second beast which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, get up and eat and fill your flesh, get your fill of flesh. And so obviously this is a warlike creature that's going to conquer others and destroy them. And after that, we'll look at the details in a minute. After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back, it had four wings like those of a bird. So it's different from the wings of an eagle, which suggest a big bird. And here the wings are smaller. It's a smaller bird, I suppose. And a leopard's smaller than a lion anyway. And on its back, it had four wings like those of a bird. The beast had four heads. And so that's unique, isn't it? It was given authority to rule. So all of these are ruling governments, you see. And we'll, as we go on in Daniel, we'll get that information. Let's look at these four beasts in detail here. The one about a lion would be obvious to Daniel as representing the Babylon, because at the main gate to the entrance to Babylon, what's called the Ishtar Gate, it was taken in pieces to Berlin and put in a museum there, but it shows a big lion. And there's the pathway going to and from this gate has lion statues on both sides. So Babylon really was, and clearly in Daniel's view, a lion. So he sees this in a dream now. The first was like a lion, had wings of an eagle. And so let's see, suppose in a dream, the vision isn't going to be so sharp. It's probably not in color. It's probably kind of fuzzy. And that's the intent of the pictures that I'm going to show you here. And so there he is, a lion with great big wings, you see. And, of course, that's a fierce creature. What would the wings suggest? Of course, they were torn off. But the wings would suggest swiftness, wouldn't they, and the ability to get around and attack from many directions. The second one was like a bear, and it had ribs in its mouth. It had been eating something, and so when we look at that one, it looks something like this. These are coming out of the water now. And the third one was another beast that looked like a leopard, and this is the most bizarre one, of course, and the most difficult one to comprehend. It had four heads. Have you seen any multi-headed animals? I have seen turtles with two heads, and I once saw a snake with three. And reptiles tend to do that sort of thing. But and of course, people, scientists who dicker with the development of animals can generate some of these things pretty easily in some kinds of animals. But this one had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. So you see the four heads there, and as it's wading in out of the ocean, and the wings are doubled on each side, one above and one below. And after that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast. So those are the first three. They're the kingdoms that are going to come after Babylon, and then eventually Persia, and after that, Greece. And the last of the four is a very powerful beast, terrifying, frightening. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot what was left. It was different from all the former beasts. So he's different. And it had 10 horns. T-E-N. You've heard the phrase a 10-horn gambler or something, but that's not what that means. But here he has 10 horns on his head. And the horns are on the head of the last beast when we look at all of these heads put together in a minute. There he is. I assume he looks something like a dinosaur or an alligator or something like that. But that looks fierce enough, doesn't it? And his claws, and he's very, very dangerous. Now, the four great beasts, the angel goes on to explain to Daniel, the four great beasts are four kingdoms that will rise from the earth, but the saints of the Most High, who is that? That's those that follow God, will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the true meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot what was left. And on down in verse 23, he gave me this explanation. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom that will appear on earth, will be different from all the other kingdoms, will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. So there you see the horns are all on the head of the last beast. And the horns each represent a king. Okay? And that's kind of interesting because the last beast represents the kingdom of the Romans. It's Rome, and the kingdom that's in power at the time the Messiah is born. And it turns out that there are 10 kings from Julius Caesar, the first king of the entire kingdom, the Caesars. Julius Caesar, Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, Galba, Otho, Metellus, and then Vespasian. And those 10 take you down to the destruction of Jerusalem. It was Vespasian and his son Titus who destroyed Jerusalem. And that's all that this beast, that God was interested in terms of this beast, I think. And these are the 10 kings of that final kingdom. They represent the horns on the beast. So the fact that there were 10 suggests. Now, there were other kings following this, but they don't enter into the story in the book of Revelation. So that may be a flaw in the whole theory, but I don't think it is. Now, in Revelation 13, we go back to that, and from what we learned in Daniel, you see, the dragon stood on the shore of the sea, saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads. 10 crowns on the horns, and the crowns represent the kings, don't they? And they're all on the last head, and on each head a blasphemous name, which means they opposed God, and no telling what the blasphemy consisted of. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, a bear, and a lion, and in reverse order of the way they appeared to Daniel, but it's the same three. And so we're pretty sure that this is, they're all stuffed together. And what would something like that look like? Can your imagination handle that? I went to the internet and I looked at a bunch of ideas, and probably the best one that I saw needed some modification, but something like this. And you see on the beast, what did I do with my... Oh, here it is. You see, here's the... See if I can make it work. There's the lion. Here are the four heads of the leopards. Here's the bear. And over here is the fierce animal that we saw. And up on top are all the 10 horns that represent the kings of that last beast. So people have drawn this idea in a variety of ways. Most of them make all the heads look alike, but I don't think they are. The 7 heads you see are the sum total of the of the four beasts that Daniel saw. One head in the lion, and one head in the bear, and four heads in the leper, and one more in the beast that represents Rome. So there's seven of them. Now, the dragon here is Satan. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. So what does that tell you? The beast is Satan's front man, isn't he? He's got all the power that Satan gave him, and he has a throne, he has great authority, he can do whatever he wants to, apparently. Now, here's something that scholars have looked at in detail, and it turns out to be somewhat trivial, I think. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. If it's a fatal wound, it doesn't get well, does it? But this one did. And so we'll see some more clues about it as we go through the chapter. We'll defer the discussion of that particular one. But it's one of these seven heads had been injured in some way that you would have expected it to die. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Now here we're talking about the cosmos. The Greek word represents all of the world. And it's everything that had been conquered by Rome. And they were quite impressed. Men worshiped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. So they're worshiping idols. And that, in effect, is worshiping Satan, isn't it? And they also worship the beast and ask, who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? And, of course, Rome was overwhelming at this point, and so no one dared stand up against them. The Jews thought about it, didn't they? And they had some rebellions, but they got put down pretty readily every time they tried that. So the beast was given a mouth to utter proud words. Now this is the red beast. And blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. We saw 42 months back in the time where we were talking about the fact, measuring the temple, that the Gentiles would be given the rule for 42 months. And it's apparently represents a period of time, 3.5 years again, I think it probably represents the time in which the Romans were attacking Israel and ultimately destroying Jerusalem. Now he opened his mouth to blaspheme God, to slander his name, and his dwelling place, and those who live in heaven. Can you think of anything else to speak against there? That pretty well covers the territory, doesn't it? Makes it total. He was given power. Who gave him power to make war against the saints and to conquer them? Who had to give him that power? The devil didn't give him that power. Why? He doesn't have the power to conquer the saints, that is, those who follow God, those who are sanctified, unless God gives him permission. And we've seen that already earlier in the book. He was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. Does that include everybody? Pretty much, doesn't it? All inhabitants of the earth. Now here, the word earth has to do with Israel. Okay? Remember the earth and the sea. We talked about that in the past. But I think we're going to see that that's a different word from down here in red. You'll see the word world in a minute. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. And that word means, of course, when the planet was created. But those whose names are written in that book, where do they live? Well, they live in Israel. And so there are some in Israel, the true Israel of God, that are excluded in that statement, aren't they? All of the inhabitants except those who are following God worship the beasts. All right, well, what does worship of the beast consist of? And we'll see that in the coming verses. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. And what that means is that this beast has the power. If he says, you're going to jail, what's your appeal? You don't have an appeal. You're going to jail. And if he says, off with your head, you don't have an appeal. That's what happens. He's got total authority, you see. And that was the power of the kings and the Caesars over all of their subjects. And so there was this, the beast had this power. He who has an ear, let him hear. So this calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Why? They're subject to that too, aren't they? And they got to be careful that they don't cross, that if they don't cross the king or the Caesar or the government in some way of Rome. Yeah. Well, of course, Satan wanted him to make war against the saints, but what I said was that God has to permit that. And I think it was with God's permission, sure. Yeah. Yeah, Satan certainly made him vicious, but God had to permit that. And so toward the end of verse 10 down there, be careful of faithfulness and patient endurance on the part of the saints. Now he sees another beast in verse 11. Another beast coming out of the earth. Now the earth, you'll notice I put it in blue several times here, and it occurs, I think, four times in this paragraph. And here we're talking about Israel, secular Israel. We're not talking about, and that was kind of confusing to you before, the faithful Israel is distinguished from the secular Israel. These are the rulers of Israel in Jesus' time who opposed Jesus. The priests and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so they made up a government, you see, which was under the Roman rule, but was different from the Roman rule, wasn't it? Now this beast had two horns like a lamb, and the word lamb there suggests that he looked kind of like what? The Messiah, Christ. He's kind of emulating what the prophets had said about the one who would come. He looked like the lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. And so he kind of gives himself away there, doesn't he? This is another bad guy. There's two of them, you see, that are serving Satan. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. So there we have a reference to that head again that had been injured. But there's one more to come, one more reference. So he exercised all the authority of the Roman Empire, and so he was obedient to the Roman rule. But he made, and you look at that and you say, well, they didn't want to worship the Caesars, and they didn't want to pay taxes and things like that. But still, you'll see in a minute, they wanted to be like the nations around them, and that's where this whole concept comes from. This beast was not created at the time of that John is writing this, but John saw him come up out of Israel. See, he came out of the earth. He didn't come out of the sea. He came out of what should have been the followers of God. So they worshiped the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed, and that they wanted a government like all the nations around them. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to Israel in full view of men, to the earth. I don't know that there's any reference anywhere to that ever happening, but you can believe that it must have because it's put in here. These people who were false teachers, the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees, could do apparently miraculous-looking things sometimes. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, He deceived the inhabitants of earth, Israel. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. So that wound that was given to the head of one of the heads of the beast was delivered by what? A sword, and that suggests that it happened in what kind of an activity? War, right. And in the handout that I give you a discussion of that, and you can read about it later. We'll look at it in just a minute, though. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast. This reminds you of what happened in the time of Daniel, that Nebuchadnezzar was told that he was the golden head of this big statue that he dreamed about, you recall? And so turn right around, and what's he doing? He's building a golden image in which he's the head of everything. And he wanted them to worship it. Daniel wouldn't worship it. You might remember that was a problem there. Or Daniel's friends wouldn't worship it. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so that it could speak and cause all who refuse to worship the image to be killed. That's the power. You worship me or die. And that's the way the rulers of Israel were in God's view. If you didn't do what they said or didn't please them, you got cast out of the synagogue, remember? And so couldn't go to the temple. There were many, many problems there that they, by their control, that they had caused the people. We'll come back to that in a minute. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. We go to 1 Samuel chapter 8, and here's where they make an image of secular, idolatrous, pagan worship government, aren't they? They said that wrong. They make an image of secular, pagan, idolatrous government. And so they said, "You're old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." And that was a huge mistake on the part of Israel, wasn't it? But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they've rejected as their king, but me. As they've done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they're doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do." And so the religious element of Israel, they wanted a king like the nations around them, and ultimately they had kings even in the time of the Caesars, but the kings were not according to the rules that God had given for a king, and we'll see that in a minute. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand. So what would that represent? A mark on the right hand, doing what was demanded of you, or on his forehead, and that would represent what? Brainwashed, thinking like he wants you to think. So that no one could buy or sell unless they had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. We'll look at that in a few minutes. So you can't do any transactions. You don't have access to buy and sell. You can't buy groceries. You can't do anything unless you toe the mark here, okay? And I don't know if that's where that phrase came from or not. Now notice how this worked out in John, the second chapter. This is just one of many examples in the New Testament. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. Where were the sacrifices for the temple to come from? Can you just go to the temple and plop down your money and pick a sheep or a lamb and go make a sacrifice of it? Is that what God intended the sacrifice to be? I don't think so. It's supposed to be something you had done, wasn't it? And not something that you purchase. So you see, they're dealing in this sort of thing and exchanging money. You couldn't buy it. You couldn't contribute to the temple treasury unless you did it in the temple coin. And so if you tried to pay that, or pay, in effect, pay your taxes with the Roman money, that wouldn't work. And of course, when you exchange the money to get the temple coins, you paid a big fee, didn't you? And so they're making a lot of money on the religious side of the Jewish system of things. So he made a whip out of cords and drove on from the temple area, both sheep and cattle, scattered the coins and money changers, overturned their tables. And what did he say? This house is supposed to be a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of thieves, right? And so you see there was a lot going on in the background. It isn't emphasized everywhere in the New Testament, but these things were happening in Jesus' time, and he was most displeased with the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, as they, particularly the Sadducees, who were the Jewish priestly family, and they tended to be crooks as well. The last verse in chapter 13 says, this calls for wisdom. That word is used four times in the book of Revelation. Twice it is involved in ascribing power and honor and glory and wisdom to God or to Jesus. And in two other cases, it says, if you're wise, you need wisdom to understand what we're talking about here, and it's ascribed to a man. This calls for wisdom. So if we're smart enough, we ought to be able to figure this out, right? If anyone has insight, let him calculate. Actually, that word in the NIV is really, in the Greek, it's just count. Let him count the number of the beast, or count out the number of the beast. For it is man's number. And you know, there have been all sorts of mistakes made about this simple little verse. The worst mistake is they say that this is the number of Satan. And all of the movies and all talk about that, don't they? But what's it the number of? It's the number of the beast. Which beast? Beast of the earth or the beast of the... It actually has to do with the beast of the earth, not the beast of the sea. For it is a man's number. It doesn't say a man's number, but it could. His number is 666. It's kind of interesting. The prefix of the church's phone number at West University Church of Christ in Houston was 666-3535. And they wonder whether we ought to get a different number. People notice things like that. So what do you suppose that means? Well, first of all, if you talk about wisdom, where would you go in the Old Testament to find out about wisdom? Solomon. That's right. And if you go back to 1 Kings 10, verses 14, 15, the weight of gold that Solomon received yearly was, I thought that was rather striking. What's the odds that it would be exactly 666 talents? And to get that number, they didn't count everything, not including the revenues from merchants and traders and all the Arabian kings and the governors of the land. He got more than that, but he had 666 talents of gold. Do you know how much gold that is? Something like 25 tons. Could we use that in this day and age? Of course, gold's heavy. That's maybe not as much gold as you might think, but it's worth billions. The mark and the number of the beast is materialism and greed, I think. That's my interpretation of this whole business. The reason why the earth beast was making Israel follow the rules of the governments around them was because you could make a lot of money. You had total power over people, and you could tax them, and you could make them do your will, and it's just greed and materialism. I think that's all that represents. People have tried to break down 666 mathematically into a bunch of other things, but I think that's not what he's talking about. It is a man's number really is and the man was Solomon. Notice in Deuteronomy 17, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, God knew what they were going to say, didn't he? He anticipated the problem. They're going to say, let us set a king over us like all the nations around us. Let us make an idol to emulate the pagan governments of the world, is what Revelation 13 is telling us about that. Be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. And of course, Samuel was very careful about that, wasn't he, in picking someone that God chose. He must be from among your own brothers, okay? Got to be an Israelite. He must be from among your own brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who's not a brother Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt. Egypt was the horse trader of the world. And don't go back to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you you're not to go back that way again. And that was a problem, incidentally, at the time of the captivity by the Babylonians, that some of the Israelites went back to Egypt, and they died there. He must not take many wives. Now, here Solomon broke every rule, didn't he? He must not take many wives. Incidentally, Solomon's stables, you know, he had a lot of horses and chariots. He must not take, and did he go back to Egypt for a wife? Yes, he did. His favorite wife was from Egypt. Must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray, and that's exactly what happened to him. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. And if he got 25 tons of gold every year, how long did he reign? 40 years. That's a lot of gold and silver, and he wasn't supposed to do that, was he? Okay, so I'm sure there are some aspects of this that I didn't make clear to you, and that's why I gave you in the handout another discussion of this, actually a copy of chapter 9, I think it is, from my book about Revelation, where it's all written out, and you can see if there's something in there you didn't quite understand. If it's explained in other words, maybe it'll be a little clearer to you. But now we've got about 5 minutes here. Nathan, why don't you speak into the microphone? It's going to be memorable, whatever it is you say. Oh, is that on? We got to get an operator back there. He has to turn up the slide in there, I bet. There we go.
Okay, Brother Elton, I was going to say that I work with a guy who we talk about this type of thing quite a bit, and he is believing pretty firmly that a lot of what we talk about tonight's in the future. And, of course, we're talking about it as if it's in the past. Is there kind of a definitive statement we can make about how do you know which is which? Or is it just intertwined throughout all of it?
Well, some of it has to do with the distant past and some with the more recent past in John's view. But I don't think any of this has anything to do with the future except as an example of what not to do. Don't make the same mistakes that they've made. And the fact that history repeats itself because we tend to make the same mistakes over and over is the problem here, I suppose. I think Revelation is a historical document that follows through from the creation on down to the time of the destruction of Israel in AD 70, and so the destruction of Jerusalem. So it's not having to do primarily with the future, but it may indeed ultimately have something to do with us. I think we have to be careful that we don't make these same mistakes. And we don't want to have a government that's based upon dictatorial, idolatrous basis. Yeah. Where is it? Way over here? Okay, John Charleston wants to say something.
In a nutshell, what is the purpose of revelation. If you look at the Gospels, it's to tell us about Jesus. If you look at the Book of Acts, it tells us about how to become a Christian and how to form the churches and what have you. And then the epistles tell us how to live individually and how to live corporately in the church.
Amen.
And it, for the most part, is quite easy to understand. What is the purpose of Revelation, then, that is so full of symbolism?
Yeah, it makes it so different.
Why is it written that way?
Because if you look at chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation, he's giving you a clue there at the start that this is how God views what's happened. What we get generally is man's view of things in the Bible as they're recorded by men. But here, God is dictating to John what he thinks about these matters. And his view of things is quite different from our view. But he goes back and gives you these clues that tell you what he's talking about as he goes along. Remember, his discussion of each of the seven churches pointed out that he knew all of their works. He knew everything they were doing. He pointed out the flaws in each congregation. And I think that was put there to tell us that's what he's doing in the book of Revelation. He's telling us his view of everything that's happened. And it's going to get gory when we get over to the destruction of Jerusalem. It's not pleasant reading at all in the coming chapters. But that's the reason why it's in symbolism, I suppose, is the fact that he's using these symbols to make clear what he's trying to say. I don't know if I would choose the same symbols. I'm sure I wouldn't. But on the other hand, if you're careful about the reading of it and refer back to the rest of the Bible, then you see what God's talking about. And he's saying these idolatrous, pagan, dictatorial governments are beasts. They're terrible beasts. They tear things up. And so they're not to be worshipped. They're not to be admired. And you don't want to be like them. And in a way, I think that's partly why the United States has been blessed. Because our government is not a beastly government like these. Our founding fathers tried to make a government that was fair. And if you have a government that has honest courts and doesn't try to take advantage of its citizens, I think God is pleased with that sort of thing. Okay, there's a... Yes?
Well, like Nathan, whenever you're talking about the valet work, I have some colleagues like that too. And one thing that I stressed to them was that they had the mindset that a lot of that was in the future and that there was going to be the 1,000-year reign and the 144,000, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, all of that.
And one way that I tried to describe to them my viewpoint is that if we take the scriptures as a whole, it flows. It makes sense.
Sure.
It doesn't contradict itself. And if you take the scriptures where, like for instance, whenever he was talking about the 144,000, you know, well, obviously if they're taking that literal and it's not symbolic, well, scripture teaches that salvation's for all man, all mm-hmm, mankind. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't limit certain amounts of people.
Now,
another thing too is the 1,000-year reign. That doesn't make sense whenever you compare it to other scriptures like 1 Thessalonians and stuff. Whenever the Lord comes, everything will be destroyed by fire. All the elements will melt in the heat and all that. So,
and whosoever will may come.
Correct.
Yeah,
so that's what I was. My point to him was, well, you know, you have to. A lot of Revelation, if not all of it, is symbolic, and I'm confident too. It's about the fall of Jerusalem and other things that have already occurred, and so that's why. That's how I tried to get him to understand that it takes a lot of study and that you have to study the scripture as a whole. It doesn't contradict itself. So.
Yeah, I think it has to be viewed in the light of the rest of the Bible.
Right.
And the 144,000 are fixing to crop up again next week, so we'll look at them when that happens. You had a point? Somebody?
That as relative as you want to, but shortly come to pass doesn't appear to me to be thousand years
later.
Yeah, and he tells him there in the end of the book, don't seal this up because this is fixing to happen.
Yeah.
what I've talked to you about is about to happen. And, you know, as far as what the overall purpose, I think it's a pretty good time to make the observation right here. What you just showed, we got a graphic picture of Satan's forces here.
Yeah, we do.
And they are incredibly fierce. I mean, they would make any right-thinking person run and hide.
They're destructive.
And now, in 14, you're about to see another army.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's going to be totally, totally different.
That's right.
So I think, you know, the overall point being that if you look around you at any given time in history, it looks like most of the time that Satan's winning this war. But in fact, he's not.
He's not going to win.
He's not going to win.
And that's one of the things that Revelation is assuring us, is that Satan's not going to win. God's going to win. And God has already won. Yeah, that's right. There's another comment back over here. You might pass that down.
Probably a lot better than most Christians do today. I mean, this wasn't confusing to them.
Probably not.
It may have been confusing to the Romans and to the Jewish leaders.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I think that's partly why it was written like it was, so that it could be clear to Christians but not to everybody else. These documents were dangerous to be held in your possession, and if it made sense to them, it might be a problem. Okay. Well, thank you for your comments, and read the handout, and it'll reiterate some of the things we've said tonight. This is sort of the crux of the matter here. We get a real good look at Satan and his forces, and as Ken was pointing out, we're going to look at Christ and his forces in coming chapters and see this battle that's going on even now. If it has to do with the battle, it does have to do with us. But it's things that have happened in the past. If we don't understand them like God understands them, then we're liable to make some mistakes. Okay, let me read the... I didn't hear any... Did the bells ring? Did we get any? Oh, the electrician has been here today. That means we may not have anything for a while. Okay. Robbie Malone was moved to the terrace in the Woodlands Room 10... after this afternoon. Please pray for continued progress for her and Bill Malone. Please pray for 2-year-old Paige, the granddaughter of a close friend of the Bradleys, who has a high-risk form of leukemia. She's had treatments, but a long road ahead of her. There will be no LTC practices this Sunday. They'll resume on the 20th. Everyone is invited to the Ingram's Ranch this Saturday. What's happening at the Ingram's Ranch this Saturday? There's been some stirring about that sort of thing. I don't know what's going on out there. I guess we have to go and find out. There's a wedding of Carter Ingram and J.T. McIntosh. Did he do the McIntosh computers? No, I guess not. Okay. Please keep this young couple in your prayers as they start their life together. This weekend is the changing of the clocks. You know that? It's going to get dark later. Or earlier, later, as after we change the clocks. And if you change the clocks and it gets dark earlier, you went the wrong direction. Okay. It is spring forward, if that makes sense to anybody. So please remember to set your clocks forward an hour Saturday night, or you'll all be at the late service. And we can't have that. That's already crowded. Okay. Any other announcements? Yes? Your mother is... in hospice care. Okay. Yes? Over here. Having problems. Her name is?
Samantha.
I'm sorry?
Samantha.
Samantha is having pregnancy problems. Okay. All right, let's have a short prayer. Father in heaven, we're thankful that we can read and understand your word. And we read it with that expectation